Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. This session, Other Lutherans, the Bataks of North Sumatra, presented in the Creekside Room by Paul Harder, disc number HAP-2005-03. Let's listen in.
We're supposed to do that, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I'm Paul Harder, and I'm doing few sessions this week about my current research that involves living among some Lutherans in the island of Sumatra, and it's an interest that I developed since about the year 2000 or so. I was a missionary in Indonesia from 93 to 99, and we were on the island of Java, and some of my favorite students came from Sumatra. They came from the ethnic group up in the northern part of the island of Sumatra, and they're called the Bataks. And so it's titled, the session's titled Other Lutherans. And so for the next hour, I will show you exactly how otherly they are. So let me just draw a quick map here. And I won't burden you with.
And you include all the islands of Indonesia?
All 13,000? No, I don't think so.
You can skip the uninhabited one.
This is roughly Sumatra, about the size of California and Oregon combined. And this is the province of Aceh, which has famously been in the news because of the tsunami. And there's a little band here. It's a province, province of North Sumatra. And there is in the middle of it a volcanic, a lake, an old lake that was formed by a huge volcanic explosion, however long ago it was, thousands, tens of thousands. Volcanic explosions ever, and the lake is called Lake Toba. It's about 40 to 50 miles north to south and about 20 to 30 miles east and west.
Wow.
And in the middle of that is an island called Samosir. And this is where the Bataks, and okay, I'm going to say Bataks, but I'm not saying Buttocks, okay? A lot of people make that. ...as coming from this area around Lake Toba. Their creation narrative, and all people have their own creation narrative. We do too. Has them being born on this little island in the middle of Lake Toba called Samosir. So this is where they're from. And so to begin today, let's begin with the traditional Batak greeting. It is Horas.
Horas.
Good. Louder. Horas.
Horas.
H-O-R-A-S. Horas. It's a bit like in Israel they have Shalom, and in Hawaii. Means firm or firm fixed or steady or secure. So what is steady or secure? It is, according to the Bataks, that your tondi. Tondi is like your soul stuff. It is the thing that makes you you. It is the thing that predates your birth and predates your conception. According to the Batak belief, when somebody is conceived and when somebody is born, they go to the tree of life, and there is a tree of life in the Batak cosmology, in the Batak worldview, and they are asked for a leaf, and that leaf is their tondi, and it is the thing from the upper world after they die. Now, this morning, for the next hour, we're going to be shifting back and forth between traditional beliefs and Christian beliefs. And we're going to see those places in between where Batak beliefs and Christian beliefs come together and form their unique identity as Lutherans. The Bataks were first mentioned in Western literature by Marco Polo. In, what are the dates, 13... And that's sort of the label that has been applied to them ever since Marco Polo, that they are a fierce tribe of cannibals. Perhaps it's because they used to file their teeth into points. And so when they smiled at you, it would be quite an odd-looking scene, I think. So for that reason, for all of history up until, you know, the 20th century, label of fierce cannibals. The Batak Highlands, in that little band of North Sumatra, was all by itself, untouched by most Western or even Eastern contact until the middle of the 19th century. When the West, the Dutch colonial powers and the Dutch colonial businesses started to come in. And so the Batak ethnic group then had to basically make a choice how they would become come into contact with the outside world. And they had a choice between Islam or Christianity. And they did not, these Bataks did not have a good experience with Islam, because in the 1820s there was a series of wars, of rebellions against the Dutch that were done on the basis of Islam. So if you think radical political Islam is something new, it's not. It was one of the things that actually drove the Bataks to embrace the missionary message of the first missionaries. So what you have with this ethnic group, the Bataks, is a whole unique culture and system of belief that all was that all ran together. They did not separate the sacred and the secular. All things were mixed up with each other. So even though that they did slowly accept things from the outside, for example, like spinning wheels to make clothes, chests. Horses and metalworking and all these things, they still retained up to the 19th century their own unique system of belief, which was that the cosmos was one, and that they all humanity, which they understood to be themselves, humanity inhabited this middle world, above an underworld and below an overworld. The upper world or overworld was the place of the ancestors. It's where everyone goes to when they die, and it's from where everyone comes or when their tondi is deposited into their body. The world of the ancestors and the spirit Batak houses have three parts. A middle part where the people live, which is on stilts, and then underneath the middle part of the house is a place where the chickens and the dogs and the pigs and the water buffalo run at night, and they sleep there at night. And the upper part of the house is an open house is where they would keep family heirlooms, because it was as a sign of the fact that the ancestors who guided them came from this upper world. So for like 5 or 10 minutes now, I'm going to talk just about this cultural background. And then what we're going to do is I'm going to present three vignettes or three scenes where we can picture ourselves living like Bataks and doing something that's both Christian and what's very native for them. Today, after Holden is primarily or largely Lutheran in background, but there's also Reformed Bataks, because there's 9 sub-ethnic groups of the Batak religion, of the Batak ethnic group. Ethnic group. 5 million of them are Lutheran up to today, and it's still hold this man in very high regard. His name is Ludvig Ingvar Nomundsen. He was born on the island of Nordstrand in the East Frisian Islands in northern Germany.
Too much danger by stealing your car up here.
No one's going to steal my car. he's probably the most successful, I guess, if you want to call it that, although I have some problems with the word successful, Lutheran missionary that ever there was. He went to Sumatra in 1862, and he lived there among the that he baptized the first four members of the Batak ethnic group. Living there because many people wanted to kill him. They saw him as a foreign devil. In honor of an ancestral spirit. Because in the Batak cosmology, when you die and your descendants are prosperous enough, they will boost you higher into the divine cosmos. And so you become your ancestor. So there's this one feast that Nomundsen attended. It was the feast of Si Atas Berita, which is the name of an ancestor. And at that feast, Nomundsen was going to be the sacrificial victim. He didn't know this, of course, when he was invited. But when he went there, he used the opportunity, because there's speech making before there's a sacrifice, and I'll talk a little bit more about sacrifice later when we talk about weddings. They had planned for him to be the sacrifice, but he, at the time of the speech making, made such an effective speech that the entire village decided to become Christian. And the speech consisted of Nomundsen telling this village of where their customs were right and where their customs emphasized hospitality and loving kindness toward the neighbor rather than sacrificing human beings. Because part of the old Batak religion was governed over by a class of priest healers called shamans. Shamans, you all know the word shaman. The Batak word is datu. So there was this group of shamans who were in charge of keeping peace with the ancestors. But a lot of what they were engaged in was keeping up their own priestly position. And so they were fear-mongers in a way, and they engaged in a lot of unsavory practices, which obviously brings about this image of Bataks being fierce cannibals. One of the rituals being, if there was warfare between two villages, a shaman from one village would kidnap a child from the other village, bury it up to its neck and pour molten lead down the child's throat, and then consume the liver of that child as a way of achieving power over this neighboring village. This story is true. I mean, I can show you a book. I don't have it with me that this comes from. So the shamanic religion of the pre-Christian Bataks was something that Ludwig Nomundsen identified as worthy of change. And what Nomundsen did was employ the resources of the Christian tradition to show that there is a better way of life. Now, this may conflict a little bit with what you think of missionaries persuading people that you will have a better life if you love Jesus. I'm not sure that Nomundsen ever said to love Jesus. He showed them a better way of life based on what he called, or what the Bataks call, adat, or custom, tradition, culture. Nomundsen introduced a culture that was Christian and that emphasized the reverence for life and not the tyrannical rule of the shamans. So there are stories of, and true stories, of Nomundsen engaging in practices where he would show the power of the Christian God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, at work in the world that was preferable to the Batak system of ancestors that must be appeased, ancestors that must be worshipped. There's a story of one time two men, they were in a coma, possibly dead. And so Nomundsen took one of the men, or convinced the shamans to give him one of the men who was in a coma, and the shamans took the other man. Nomundsen was a practitioner of homeopathic medicine, which was a 19th century German or European tradition. There's still homeopathic medicines around, I mean, obviously, St. John's Wort and stuff like that. Anyway, so Nomundsen used a homeopathic tradition of caring for someone who was struck by lightning. This makes no sense to me, but it worked. Nomundsen buried this man who had been struck by lightning up to his neck, and the man got better. Okay? The other man, who the shamans tended to, died. And so with a number of these instances, Nomundsen gradually worked his way up from village to village, beginning about here, down here is, he came here to Padang in 1862, made his way up here by about 1865, and then through moving from village to village and doing his work as a healer, and Nomundsen was a healer and that and an educator, and I think primarily that was the most attractive things for the Bataks, what they saw in the Christian faith. He slowly made his way to Lake Toba, and he eventually died in 1918, having made this entire region Christian here.
That example you gave, did he just get lucky a lot, or was he actually sort of did he eventually bring some health practice that was more effective than what they had?
He was capable, and he also brought in a number of Western medical practices that worked far better than the shamans. I don't know. By that time, maybe someone else in this room. Keeping clean and.
Yeah, I don't know if he would have been using it, but
it's
known that it wasn't universally accepted.
That's an interesting question. You'd probably have to go to the archives of the Mission Society in Barmen, Germany, and find out what sort of medical practices he engaged in. But the medicine and education were the two things that I think were most attractive materially for the Bataks. And then came the awareness that for the Bataks, that the name of God was different. In the Batak cosmology, there is a high god called Mulajadi Nabulon, which means the great beginner, or the great beginning beginner. It's sort of a repetitive sort of name, but the great beginning beginner, Mulajadi Nabulon, Nomundsen told them was actually the God, the father of Abraham and Sarah, the one who was covenanted with as blessing in the Old Testament and then became incarnate in Jesus Christ in the New Testament, and the traditional Christian story. Nomundsen the name of Yahweh was something that was at one point new for the people of Israel as well. The first thing that Nomundsen did as a theological act was to translate Exodus. Okay. Bible would you translate first, you'd think? The Gospel of John, maybe. Something like that. No, Exodus. Why Exodus? Because there you have the revelation of the name of God to the people, to the Hebrew people. Yahweh, Before then, what was God's name? Well, if you read the Bible, especially in Hebrew, you can ask Terry Fredheim this. The God of Israel has a number of names. And, you know, Elohim. Is a name of God that is imprecise, that is unworkable today, because Mulajadi Nabulon was the god of the shamans who was involved in a number of unsavory practices, which I talked about, involving ritual cannibalism. A cannibalism, by the way, they didn't eat people for food, for sustenance. It was mainly the shamans who would ritually consume the liver or heart of a criminal or something in order to gain the power, to negate the power of a criminal, or to use the heart or liver or parts of the bodies in order to gain power over another village. Anyway, so... Christian faith got off the ground in Sumatra. Okay. Batak Lutheran parishes in America. It's one in Los Angeles, Seattle, Denver, and New York. They're soon to become a special non-geographic synod of the ELCA. Part of the sort of the cultural logic of being Batak. If you visited them in the 19th century. But the basic Batak value is prosperity. And so migration to a better place is part of their cultural logic. Sons go out when they're of age and found another village. And so that happened all through the 19th and 20th century, aided by education, which Nomensen brought. The Bataks were some of the best educated people of Indonesia, and they quickly rose in the when Indonesia became a nation in the late 1940s, they became generals, professors, doctors, lawyers, et cetera, because of their education, which they had. And this migration continues today mainly to the United States and Australia. And that's, yeah.
Where did they get the money to do all this? Education.
Well, the schools were poor, but what Nomensen did was begin education through Bible, Bible education. Basic literacy, using the Bible, which he translated into Batak, and then the Batak languages had their own characters, which were monosyllabic characters, and then he Romanized it. He was one of the first to translate the original Batak script into Roman characters, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, H, K, L, M, N, O, P, Latin alphabet, okay. And so literacy was the first step. And then once people were literate and were numerically literate, they learned how to, you know, account and to learn basic accounting practices, they were very much sought after by the government. So once they entered the ranks of the government, the Dutch colonial government, they became That's my 25-cent tour of Batak Christian history. What other questions?
So did they wind up then spreading throughout other parts of Indonesia?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so then, are there Batak churches throughout significant parts of Indonesia?
Everywhere in Indonesia, every major city has a church. The largest, I should mention, the largest Batak Lutheran church is called the HKB. It's called the Hakabepe. They use the pronunciation of Indonesian. The HKBP. sort of ethnocentric. like the old, you know, American Lutheran Church was all Norwegians, you know. There's still a Volkskirche in German, Volkskirche, a people church. It's not a bad thing, but they have engaged in practices that invite other people in, but it doesn't work.
Did you sure they already become Batak?
My name is Paul Harder Simon Juntak. I became a Batak. I became a member of a clan. The Bataks have this clan-based system. There's these old famous clan names, Simon Juntak, Sitoris, Lumbantobing.
HKBP stands again for what?
Huria, H-U-R-I-A. Huria means community, obviously Christian, Protestant, so the Huria Christian Batak Protestant is sort of a jumble of words that means the Batak community, Protestant church, I've never translated this actually, the
Protestant community of Protestant Christians of
Batak. So the Batak Christian Protestant community. Yeah, that's what it is. Their headquarters are up near Lake Toba, and
How did you get from a German Lutheran to American Lutherans being so tied in? I mean, because there's this heavy ALC and now ALCA connection to the Batak Church, as I understand. I mean, is there still a heavy German Lutheran Church connection as well?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there is. That's sort of the German church. I think the Bataks like Americans slightly better because we tend to be more egalitarian. The Germans tend to, have this sense of ownership, and they sort of show it. They're a bit patronizing. They can be a bit patronizing. Americans tend to be more, you know, one-on-one. You know, we're just folks.
Did the Germans also have to withdraw, to some extent, during World War II from this area?
That's an interesting story. I wasn't going to get into it, but now that you ask. In 1940, when the Japanese invaded Indonesia, there was a Dutch colonial government, okay? And so because the Dutch and the Germans were at war. So the Germans were who had staffed the leadership positions of the HKBP, the HKBP, and when the Japanese invaded, they interned all the Dutch, and the Germans went home. So at the end of the day, what all this political stuff meant among Europeans and Japanese during World War II, it meant that suddenly the Batak Lutherans were in charge of their own church, and one of the first independent Lutheran churches in Asia. Suddenly, 1940, it was a crisis, and there it was, and they survived. Mm-hmm. Okay, before we get into some wild scenes, any other thing? Questions anybody wants to ask? Okay.
They also became the first, as far as I know, maybe the only member of the World Federation that did not have the name Lutheran in its name.
So that's right.
Mm-hmm. And so the congregations here in the state are all HKBP.
Well, they use ELCA buildings, and one or two have joined them. Two of them have split internally.
Oh.
And wanted to join the Missouri Synod.
Oh,
Well, there's this old for a second batak, and when there is two bataks, they will go looking for a third batak, and when there is a third batak, they will form a choir, and when there is four bataks, they will form a church. And when there is five bataks, they will form two churches. So there's this old, you know why there's different Lutheran churches, because for ethnic reasons, and also there's theological and social issues that divide. Some find Missouri Synod more amenable for them. Some.
And which one's Missouri Synod?
The parish in Los Angeles has split. Half of the congregation has gone over to the Missouri Synod, Missouri Synod Parish. I think this is kind of a secret, actually, so I don't tell anyone. I mean, this is sort of sensitive political stuff, but yeah, so one half of the parish has stayed in the ELCA building, and half of them have gone to the Missouri Synod. This is vibrancy. It is schism in a way, and it's lamentable, but it's also vibrancy.
Is there some amount of love or resentment for them within the Indonesian culture because of their connection with the West?
Well, I didn't mean to give the sense that there's lots of Bataks in the government or academia. Well, there are in the academia and in the church, but not really. They still have this reputation even among Indonesians. I mean, Indonesia has 240 million people, right? Bataks are only 9 million. They do have this reputation of being combative because they do talk and argue loudly. And the majority ethnic group in Indonesia is Javanese, people in Java, who are very elegant, refined people. Who really do not like arguments or loud talking. So there's this sort of thing if Northern Europeans think Italians or Mediterranean people are loud, boisterous, you know, it's that sort of cultural sort of difference.
So what are those Northern ones? What religion are they? The Javanese or?
Oh, Javanese are mainly Muslim. With 9% Christians, so
9%.
Yeah, Indonesia generally is 85% Muslim, 9%, 10% Protestant and Catholic, and 5% Buddhist. Yeah.
And so of that 10%, you said there are like 5 million
Lutherans.
Indonesia is the fourth largest population country in the world after
that's right.
And India, us. That sounds to me like they almost have the same percentage of Lutherans as we do in the U.S.
Oh, I never thought of it that way. What percent Lutherans are there in the U.S.?
Well, what is it, about 9-10 million of us, since we've got about 280, what's the population of the U.S. now, 285, almost that.
Something like that.
We're 6%, 5%, something like that.
Well, there's some sub-ethnic groups, sub-ethnic groups of the Bataks who are Muslim, the Angola and the Mandailing. If you drink coffee, Mandailing, Sumatran coffee generally comes from Mandailing. It's grown by Muslim Bataks. But also Lutheran Bataks also grow coffee as well. So if you drink Sumatra coffee, it's a Lutheran drink. Yeah. All right, let me go into some specifics here. That's just an overview, and I hope we have an overview. I wanted to ask you, where are you on Holy Saturday, the Saturday before Easter? Think about where you are as a Christian. I assume we're all Christians in the room. So on Holy Saturday, the night before Easter, where are you? The Bataks are all gathered at their ancestral graves. What's that mean? When you're buried in as a Batak, you're buried in a family mausoleum. It's called a tugu, T-U-G-U, a tugu. It's an ancestral grave. All the bones of all your ancestors on your father's side are in there. So like Hansen, that's an old Lutheran name. My grandfather was named Hansen. And if we were Batak, we would have an intense conversation for several hours, finding out exactly which Hansen we're each from. Because my grandfather Hansen came from Norway as well. So anyway, so the patrilineal descent, which is what anthropologists call their kinship system, the patrilineal descent group, which means where your father comes. What's your last name?
Anderson.
Okay. So Andersons would have this mausoleum back probably in Norway, which would be quite big by now because there's a ton of Andersons, right? And on Holy Saturday, all the Bataks go back to their father's line, grave site, and clean it, and pray loudly, and sing loudly, all at 2 in the morning on Easter morning. So they all, and it's like a family reunion. Now, if you all have family reunions, everybody comes to one place probably in the summer and has a barbecue or stuff like that in America. They do this on Holy Saturday. Now, why do they do that? Because of the importance of the kinship system, which I didn't explain that well because it's pretty complicated. But the father's kinship line is the most important identity marker for you as a Batak. And so on the night before Easter, they have long prayers and they have this family reunion in the dark, where they have a big picnic and they clean the graves and bring flowers. There's lanterns and there's a big procession, and people come from all over to go back to their family village. So, for example, the Simonjuntak. And so if you can make it, if it's like a family vacation, to go back there and do that. Now, why do they do that? Because according to the Christian tradition, where was Jesus?
In the tomb.
In the tomb, good. Now, think more cosmically, where was Jesus? Or Jesus Christ, where was Christ? In the tomb, but also...
Preaching to the dead,
Jesus was in hell. Now, for us, hell is a bad place, right? A place that you do not want to go to. Christ was with the dead, all right? So Christ is with the dead. And the Bataks, as Christians, believe that Jesus rose again on the third day and made a victory march through hell. And in Latin, that is called the Descensus ad Inferos, which is the descent into hell. It's part of our creed. Descended into hell, and the third day rose again. So the Bataks took this quite literally, and for that reason, they go to their dead. Why? Because they used to be called ancestor worshippers, which is a bad word that the missionaries loved to call people and certain people in Asia. Oh, they worship their ancestors. They worship their grandparents who are dead. Well, that's true. Involved the ancestors who were dead, the middle world, the people who are alive and having babies and eating rice and all this stuff and having parties, and also the place of the underworld, which is, this is getting a little technical, but where lived Nagapadoha, which is the great green serpent who was the source of evil in the underworld. But when Jesus died and was called the harrowing of hell or descended into hell, Jesus went to be with the ancestors and preached to the pagan dead. There's that quote from 1 Peter talking about preaching to the pagan dead, because obviously Abraham and Sarah didn't know Jesus. But when Jesus went into the realm of the dead, Abraham and Sarah and all the prophets of Israel met Jesus. So that's why I asked you, where are you on Holy Saturday? What do you think about that? Is that Orthodox? Is that, I use the word Orthodox advisedly, small o, a small o, not a capital O, but do you think that, what do you think about that? Because there's a controversy in the Batak Lutheran Church about that. Many bishops, Batak bishops, will say, do not go to your family graves on Holy Saturday because it's a pagan holdover or something like that. And some other bishops will say, okay, if you must do that, bring along a deaconess. Something like that.
Well, for the major parts of Easter, traditional Easter tradition, they have pagan holdovers and, you know, not tradition, I mean, you know, going back to the beginning. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it doesn't bother us, does it?
We're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Often. We're more removed from it, so we don't necessarily...
Well, or we've been so sucked in by it, we don't realize it's our culture.
Mm-hmm. Right, or we're so disconnected from what the traditional, you know, belief system might have been long before we were Christianized,
mm-hmm.
that we don't connect with it centuries, and such, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember a conversation with a woman in South Africa.
Louder, Paul.
A woman in South Africa who had been a lifelong Lutheran, essentially, and then and she said, you know, the Western Christians accuse us of... keeping too many of our old African traditions, and they say we worship our ancestors because of so on and so forth. She says, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be a lot different from what Western Christians do when they honor the saints.
Oh.
And I was going to say, it's very similar to the Catholic tradition in Latin America, you know, Day of the Dead. So.
The Day of the Dead, right, yeah. That's when is it again? That's
also
Halloween, right. So what I just described is this Batak Lutheran practice, and I really have no clue if they do it in America. I don't think they do it in America because they need an ancestral grave, a shrine, yeah, something like that. That's called the Bua Ijo, the return on Holy Saturday to the ancestral graves. What do you do at funerals? I mean, we've all been to funerals and lost people that we've loved, and they're sad occasions, and okay, funerals are what they are. But you all know what you do at funerals.
Whether we think they should abandon that, and I think that's the whole thing where missionary work has been criticized is we get rid of all of their culture. What's wrong with that? It doesn't sound like it's anything wrong with it if they realize that, you know, that it's part of their culture and that Jesus went back. Hmm. I kind of forgotten that when they say he descended into hell, and oh good, got Abraham and Sarah and all the rest of them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
the before New Testament people. So I would say, oh, God, we've got to stop those bishops from...
But it's interesting, the bishops are Indonesian. They're Batak.
They're Batak bishops.
You know, they're Batak, but who's influencing them?
What seminary do
they go through? Yeah.
To go back to your question, I mean, at a funeral, we commend the deceased to God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And remember... and pray and whatever that and God receive this person into your realm.
Mm-hmm. And someone said sing hymns as well. Bataks do the same thing, except it involves dancing and smiling and crying and smiling at the same time. The second little scenario I wanted to present to you this morning is called a tortor. Tortor is just the word, Batak word for dancing. And I love to go to Batak funerals, which is a strange thing to say, because there is so much, there's an orchestra, a Batak orchestra. They have reed instruments, sort of like an oboe is a double reed instrument. And they have lutes and mandolins, they're like lutes and mandolins, and then a gong. A gong section is the percussion sort of percussion session, and there's much is the special kind of dancing as there is at weddings called tortor, and it looks somewhat like this. It's a conga line. Everybody would dance in a line, and then move their hands like this.
Now, the controversy is in the church, sort of like whether you, the controversy whether you should go to your ancestral graves or not, is whether you should dance like this, or like this, or like this at a funeral. And the bishops have said, when you're dancing at a funeral, you should not dance like this, because there then you. Is going into the world of the dead, the upper world, and is a source in primordial Batak belief, is a possible source of blessing. So the controversy is that the Batak bishops have said, dancing like this at a funeral is forbidden, that you dance like this, and you should not dance like this either, because it is the family of the dead person that traditionally dances like this to give the blessing to other people, the blessing of the dead person who's departing into the overworld, into the upper cosmos, the world of the dead. The family of the dead person can dance like this and give blessing. So when you dance at a funeral, you should only dance like this. And they go on all night, and there's much drinking and smoking, and it's just a very large party. And they dance around the body of the deceased.
So this would be a blessing to...
This is neutral.
Okay.
This is neutral. This is the family of the dead giving the blessing to others, and this is people from outside the patrilineal descent group, the kinship system, the Anderson or the Hansen. People outside that family can receive the blessing of the dead person. They send kids off to buy ice. And I was at one funeral where they ran out of ice and they used popsicles. And so there was this old man in the coffin, in the casket, with melting purple and red popsicles around his head.
What a way to go.
Yeah. So that's Tortor. And the reason that Dan on Sunday, weddings and funerals, is because music was the way in which people, certain sensitive people, became mediums for the ancestors to speak. So good Batak music is when a certain sensitive person, usually a woman, falls into a trance and starts mediating the speech of an ancestor. And so it's ecstatic. Music is ecstatic. You are transported is bringing the words of the ancestor. This is, the missionaries thought this is clearly not Christian, and I think I would agree with that the speech of the ancestor the person who is speaking, the ancestor who is speaking, is probably not the ancestor, but the opponent. To the extent that in guidebooks, travel guidebooks published in Europe, recommend going to Batak churches to hear music, hear the hymn singing, the choral singing, as one of the main things to see in North Sumatra. The last thing, the last five or 10 minutes here, scene that I want to bring before you is called a Jembar. Jembar is the practice of the distribution of wealth that's done on special occasions. Jembar can be translated into our cultural categories. What part of the turkey do you get on Thanksgiving? Does it matter what part of the turkey you get on Thanksgiving? I mean, is there one part that's better than others?
White meat.
White meat, yeah, it's healthier. Yeah.
Gizzard.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when the Bataks have a ritual meal, like at a wedding or other special occasions, when they open a new church, when they dedicate a new church building or something like that. For a wedding, for example, they usually slaughter a water buffalo. A water buffalo is killed and boiled up in these big pots, cut up and boiled in these big pots. And the certain parts are given to certain family members. So, for example, the Anderson in-laws would get the upper quadrant of the water buffalo's head, the upper right quadrant of the water buffalo's head. Over here at this wedding, there is a guest from Holland. Oh, this is a tourist. This is someone who should be honored. So the tourist will get the lower left quadrant of the water buffalo's head. And people of honor receive certain honorable parts of the water buffalo that's been cut up. And this, they also do this with pigs and chickens. And so at funerals and weddings and dedication of church buildings, the longest part of the ceremony is this distribution of the blessings, the gifts, the offerings that people bring and that people give out. I was at a dedication of a church where I saw 90-year-old women dancing with bottles of beer, and there's dancing, as I mentioned, in the tortor, and they bring the offering to the honored people of honor who are there, whether it's the bishop who happens to be there or whoever. Every major occasion, and at especially big weddings or funerals, there is a type of jember or distribution that involves the extravagant throw it into the river. And all this will be accompanied by loud music and dancing, and there'll be this procession up to the river, and they'll throw half of a water buffalo into the river as a sign of enjoyment and prosperity.
Who gets the rump end of the water buffalo?
Kids. Yeah. That's the way it goes down.
Mm-hmm. Are there any dishonored parts of the body? Are they discarded, or?
I'm sure there's parts that are discarded. I've never seen that part of it, though.
I mean, it's not a deliberate dishonor or whatever.
No, I've never.
All various ranks of positive.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. Ancestors, and they're not offerings per se to God, the God the Father Jesus. It's more enjoyment of prosperity and blessings that people carry around during all this dancing.
So is there any bishop controversies associated with it?
Yes, the extravagant throwing of parts of the water buffalo into the river or over a cliff is thought to be a little bit too pagan, because it smells like they're offering it to the deceased ancestors. So, and all these things are eminently negotiable, because remember I said Bataks love to talk and are argumentative. Every village has their own tradition. So if you go to a wedding in this village and say, okay, who gets the upper right quadrant of the water buffalo's head? They'll say, oh, the mother-in-law of the bridegroom, obviously. If you go to another village, they will say, no, that goes to the father-in-law of the bride. And then they'll have this long discussion of who's right and wrong. So there's these intra-Bata long, long conversations about who's right and wrong.
Terry Fredo's presentation, is there exercise and practice of worship and life very relational then in the sense of it's an argument with one another rather than necessarily.
Oh, you mean
how much do bishops have authority, or is more of it done in more collegial?
Mm-hmm. Well, they make a great distinction, and this is what the missionaries did, Nomundsen and other missionaries. They make a big distinction between adat, or custom, and culture, custom and culture, and religion and church and custom. So this, for example, who gets which parts of the water buffalo, the church has no role in it. No. Only when there are certain encroachments between them is they step in.
As pastor of the International Church, the Bratislava International Church in Slovakia, another couple within the Indonesian embassy. They were actually there first.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Indonesian ambassador before that, we had met, and I assume that she was Muslim, and there wasn't a regime. I mean, we were together socially once, but there wasn't really a way to ask that question without messing things up, because we were in the home of the Indian ambassador at that time. Yeah. But these people were very faithful
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
at our church, and I thought it's very interesting. The ambassador from the world's largest Muslim country, be Lutheran, and Christian, mm-hmm. and very faithful in worship.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, there's a number of things going on there. There's this the education. Lutherans are yep. famous for education, and so they rise very quickly. They're villagers in the sense that they are very attuned to the politics. The politics of any institutional group, whether it's a corporation, whether it's the diplomatic service, or whether it's just your neighborhood, they're incredibly canny when it comes to interpersonal relations. Very social. I find it very tiring to go there because you talk almost 21 hours a day, and it's always this constant negotiation. And it comes from the old status negotiation, because every village had their own tribal head, a village elder, a leader. And to get that, it was not a democracy, it was whoever had the most charisma. So it's charisma, which is called sahala in Batak. I didn't talk about that, but yeah, the Consul General of the Indonesian the Indonesian Consul General in Chicago is a Batak Lutheran as well.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can we learn some things from that?
What was the question?
Can we learn some things?
Material prosperity. I go back and forth on this. That's one of the main engines driving Batak culture, pre-Christian and post-Christian, prosperity, or another word is blessing. When you're prosperous, you are blessed. Now this has good things and this is bad things. Yeah, because obviously we are blessed. Long lives, healthy children. Lack of want. So, as you decide, I don't know.
So as Bataks move around the world, mm-hmm. it seems to me it'd be tough to keep together an ethnic cultural identity line
mm-hmm.
as you. Time separation from those origins.
Mm-hmm.
You have some sense of mm-hmm. do they begin to lose this gradually? Is one's ethnic tribal identity strong? probably stronger than one's identity as an Indonesian.
Well, that's a good place to end. Websites. The Batak Lutheran Parish in Los Angeles has a big website. You know, they post all the pictures of their Christmas celebrations and weddings and so on. And the children growing up in LA, they don't know how to dance tortor. They don't know how to organize a Batak wedding. They don't know. They lose the knowledge of their culture. So, I don't know, Hansons and Andersons, they've lost a lot too. I mean, you can still go to St. Olaf Christmas Festival and eat lefse and rumagrut and all that stuff. But what have you lost, what have you left behind that you regret missing? It's the same sort of thing I think their children are going through. Their children are going to become Americans. They're going to become Asian Californians.
What? Oh yeah, that's maybe answers my question. What race are they? Oriental? Or Asian?
Or well, it's lost in the mists of history where they come from, but it's some sort of migration from continental Asia, whether it's South China. As I said, 40% of the language is Sanskrit, so it's really anyone's guess where they came from.
But when you look at them?
They're dark-skinned. Dark-skinned, straight black hair. Flat nose, broad faces. They're not especially short, and with better childhood nutrition, they're becoming as tall as any American. So,
when did Islam arrive in Indonesia, and what's the reality?
Well, Islam came with coastal traders from Arabia and South Asia in the beginning around the 14th century, and so it's the coastal harbors that became Muslim first, and then it slowly spread or not into the islands. So, for example, Islam never spread into the Batak territory because the Bataks had their own. Vibrant culture. I don't know how to answer your question.
My sense is that Indonesia is a hodgepodge of many tribes, cultures, etc. And that in some sense, well, so what unifies that? Does the common sense of Indonesian unify them? Do the common sense of rejection of Dutch rule unify them? Do the common sense of Islam?
Well, it's the Indonesian project. It's one of the largest experiments in democracy that we have in the world today, next to India. So, however Indonesia goes, so goes that. Yeah.
I was going to say, my connection is that we've been sponsoring a Luther Sound student who's Batak Luther.
Oh, Andar.
And he came here to study Islamic studies at Luther Sound.
That's right, yeah.
For that very reason, because of the, you know, it sounds to me like if you're Batak Christian in Indonesia, you can't necessarily learn.
They would love to have you visit. So if you ever think about going, it's very safe. Mm-hmm. That part of Sumatra is like North Dakota. Lutherans are thick on the ground. It's 90% Christian, so it's a great place to visit.
But is it pretty there?
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
No, snorkeling around the water. Actually, that.